This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Take one executive order, give people a weekend to think and act on it, and now what? Is once again a fair question to ask. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, January the 30th. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. This was an interesting weekend for corporate America. It was an interesting weekend for America, in all honesty. But our slice today is the response to President Trump's executive order on refugee admissions to this country by people running some of the biggest companies in this economy. Tech leaders, including Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Airbnb's Brian Chesky, were some of the first to speak up against it. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart on this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, not at all surprising that it was tech companies that jumped on this first, right?
Not at all. You know, I think the thing that people don't realize about the tech industry is that it has a really disproportionately high number of foreign-born workers and foreign-born immigrants who went on to start huge, now Fortune 500 companies. And that includes, as I'm sure you've seen thrown around, Steve Jobs, who was the son of a Syrian immigrant. It's an industry that relies heavily on foreign talent in a lot of different ways and has global reach. So you've got companies with, you know, like Google saying, look, we have between 100 and 200 employees who are affected right this second who are stuck overseas. And Uber saying we have drivers who went home to visit their families and now can't come home.
Let me ask you, though, to as best as we can play this forward a little bit, because there are reports now of more executive orders coming out that are going to hit tech in different ways.
Yeah, something that we've been looking at really since the election was this question of H-1B visas, because as you know, jobs and immigration are basically, you know, hits one and two on President Trump's playlist. And on its face, H-1B visas hit both. And there's an argument that they take engineering jobs from Americans or high-tech jobs from American workers. People have concerns about this. I talked to Daniel Costa. He's the director of immigration law and policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. That's a Washington-based think tank. And he says, look, everybody knows there are problems.
Having skilled immigration to the United States, bringing in talented workers from abroad is undeniably a good thing. But the H-1B program in particular is, one, not actually immigration. Workers are non-immigrants. And two, it's structured in a way that's a very useful tool for corporate exploitation.
You know, it's likely that tech companies, because they are dependent on these workers, might not fight changes too much, depending on how sweeping they are. Nobody wants to see, nobody in the tech industry wants to see this program go away completely. Everybody was anticipating that there may be changes.
Let me ask you the bigger uncertainty question here, right? Because tech, as you know and as we've been reporting, is the center of innovation in this economy. How do you innovate when you don't know what the rules of the game are going to be?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you could certainly apply that question to almost every business in America right now. But when you don't know where your talent source is going to come from, when you don't know if your employees are going to be able to make it home, when you don't know where they're going to be stuck and for how long, it certainly distracts you from the business of doing business. You know, it took a lot of these tech leaders a while to be vocal about any concerns that they might have had about the Trump administration. But now that it's affecting their ability to do business, it's not a surprise that they're getting a little louder.
And we should point out here that, you know, 10 days ago, a lot of these same people who are speaking out now in varying degrees of strenuousness were sitting in the conference room up at Trump Tower with Mr. Trump.
Absolutely. And, you know, everybody in business in particular has taken a bit of a wait and see approach, right? Let's see what he does versus what he says. And now that he is doing things, you're seeing a somewhat expected response. And there's always going to be controversy then about how much these companies or these leaders collaborate or don't. Travis Kalanick is saying on Facebook,
the CEO of Uber,
the CEO of Uber, exactly, is saying, look, I'm going to take these questions directly to President Trump because I'm on the Economic Council. And that is part of the reason that I agreed to do that in the first place. But it's going to be complicated days ahead.
Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
On Wall Street today, chaos, uncertainty. Does the markets no favors? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not just tech companies or big companies or profit-making companies who are likely to be affected by the travel ban. When we were in Erie, Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago for our series that's called The Big Promise, a look at how President Trump's promises are going to play out over the next year, we talked to a woman named Delaina Jackson. She runs the International Institute there. It is a refugee resettlement agency. Delaina, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, same to you.
What was your first thought Friday when you heard this news?
Disappointment, a really big disappointment, a lot of sadness.
Tell me about what the folks in your office, the folks who come to you for services, what are they saying?
A lot of the same thing. I mean, just sadness, confusion. You know, they believe in the American system. And, you know, I think this was a huge disappointment to them. So.
What did you spend your weekend doing?
Saturday was a bunch of phone calls, reporters, a conference call, talking with some staff members and community members. And then Sunday was a rally. We had a rally here in Erie, which was well attended. And it was actually a pick-me-up after a very long week. So
do you have a plan now?
Well, we have a plan. We're still going to be here. So that's not going to change. But, you know, we're going to look a little different. And we're trying to figure out, you know, I think everyone is trying to figure out what all of this means.
Yeah. When you say you're going to look a little different, I mean, this is going to sound way more callous than I mean, but this is a business model dilemma for you.
It is. Yeah. I mean, a nonprofit is still a business and we still have to operate with a positive bottom line. So
what are you going to do? I mean, if this is now the foreseeable future, at least 4 months worth of this executive order being in effect, what are you going to do?
Well, I think that's a conversation I've been having with folks at our headquarters, and it's a negative impact on a local economy that really needs people employed.
Yeah, well, remind me, give me a sense of the importance of the refugee population to the folks and the businesses in Erie.
Yeah, so, you know, we estimate there's roughly about 20,000, you know, refugee and immigrant individuals here in town. You're talking, you know, roughly 150 people employed, 150, 200, you know. So, you know, that's going to change the landscape of the city. It's going to change the diversity here. You know, we're just waiting to see how that changes.
Have you heard from businesses in town yet?
We've heard from businesses, landlords, you know, our supporters. Like I said, Erie's a great town. I couldn't be happier with the support that we've seen. So,
yeah, you mentioned landlords. So this goes to the housing that you find for these folks and obviously the business receipts for the landlords, too.
Yep, all of that.
I know you said you had to pick me up on Sunday. You sound a little down.
Well, you know, it's a little hard to walk into an office of clients and staff and, you know, put on that face that everything's okay.
Delaina Jackson at the International Institute of Erie, Pennsylvania. Talk to you again soon, all right?
Yep, thanks.
We talked to a bunch of people while we were in Erie, nonprofits and for-profits, workers and bosses as well. Kerry Quigley is the president of Sterling Technologies. It's a rotational molding plastics manufacturer, and that's a phrase I learned when I was out there. He had said right before Inauguration Day, he was pretty excited at the prospects of a Trump presidency. So after last week, We called him up to see how he is feeling now. Kerry, thanks for coming back on.
Nice to talk to you.
First of all, how you feeling now? We talked to you, what, 10 days, 2 weeks ago, maybe? You were feeling pretty good about the incoming administration. How do you stand now?
You know, we're still pretty excited about it. Some of the previous predecessors, they talked about change. We feel excited. We feel like President Trump's in place and we're starting to see change.
Have to ask you about his immigration policy announcement this past Friday. Dependent as you are on refugee and immigrant labor, which we talked about while we were there, how much of a problem is that going to be for you, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, we have to be somewhat concerned. We have approximately 25% of our workforce right now are immigrants. Now, some of those people have been with us for 6 years now, and they've certainly done a great job. But a lot of the workforce that is fueling that workforce for us, that unskilled labor in our area, it is an immigrant workforce. So there is some concern there.
What do you see? What do you hear when you get out and you walk around the shop floor? I mean, it's super loud out there. We were out there when we were in Erie, but what are you hearing people say?
You know, I don't hear too much concern out there right now. You know, everybody's working away. We do buy some components from the Pacific Rim that go into some of the products we manufacture. There's been talk about that. If people are worried, if that goes away, if we start to lose a strategic advantage or a purchasing advantage that's going into our product line.
You mean with exports and trade protectionism and all that?
Correct.
Yeah, so you're willing to deal with that with the hope that other areas of what the Trump administration is going to do are going to be positive for you?
I think we are, because I think it still levels the playing field. So, we're willing to accept the change. I think certainly everybody recognizes if we want to make America great again, then we've got to have manufacturing. So, and that's the business we're in. I think if we were able to make it through the past 8 years, maybe the next 8 years can get even better.
What are the next 6 months looking like for you?
Well, we're busy. Backlog still looks good. We've got some expansion that we're working with. So next 6 months for us right now looks pretty decent. You know, we're excited to hopefully maybe see some change with what's going on with the Affordable Care Act, maybe how mm-hmm. that will work its way with the business.
You talked about the Affordable Care Act when we were out there and how that's a big issue for you and how you're going to have to look at your budget for next year. Are you troubled at all that there seems to me some starting and stopping from the Republicans on what exactly they're going to be able to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we're worried about every year until, I guess, we get to the finish line. I mean, certainly, yeah, I think it is something we're concerned about because it's got such a heavy-weighted cost to what it can do to us as a small company.
Yeah, and it's possible your workers would have to bear more of the load.
Right.
Right. Kerry Quigley, president of Sterling Technologies out there in Erie County, Pennsylvania. Kerry, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, you guys. Have a great day.
Take care. Some of the early pushback against President Trump's travel restrictions came from one of the seven countries specified in the executive order, Iran. The Iranian foreign minister tweeted that his country, quote, will take reciprocal measures, end of quote. Caught in the middle of a lot of what's going on are multinational companies, specifically in Iran's case, Boeing. The plane maker has a multi-billion dollar deal to sell 80 planes to Iran and is in fierce competition with Europe's Airbus to get into that lucrative market. The Boeing sale was always balanced precariously on the back of the Iranian nuclear deal, to which this travel ban adds another level of geopolitical risk. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
It's almost impossible for Americans to do business with Iran. Do anything to, quote, facilitate business transactions, and you could be fined or jailed, says Suzanne Maloney of the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy.
You know, buying a cheap lunch for an Iranian who might be interested in some sort of a product or opportunity, it can be interpreted as engaging at a professional conference.
The one loophole is planes, created by the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and six countries. So Boeing is building 80 aircraft for Iran Air for an estimated $10 billion. One question is whether Tehran is offended enough by the U.S. travel ban to scuttle the deal. Sanam Vakil at the Chatham House think tank in London doubts it.
Ultimately, the economics behind a nuclear deal was to return investment to Iran. And I think that behind the scenes, this wouldn't be in the Iranian government's interest.
Iran's president took power promising foreign investment, and he is up for re-election. The other risk is D.C. President Trump has called the Iran nuclear deal the worst ever, and Congress could also vote to kill it. The thing is, the Boeing piece of it creates lots of U.S. factory jobs for the president, says Cliff Kupchan of the Eurasia Group.
And if he brings down the deal, he's got angry allies, he's got no sanctions regime probably, and he's got a rejuvenated Iranian nuclear program. If he's a deal maker, that ain't a good deal.
Perhaps not. Still, the raising of drawbridges surely brings some new risks to the airplane deal. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, his son Howie told us that his father is a computer and the hard drive just does not run out.
Becoming Warren Buffett, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 122 points today, 0.6%, closed at 19,971. Yes, that is 20,000 in the rearview mirror. The NASDAQ down 47 points, 0.8%, 56.13. The S&P 500 dropped 13 points, about 0.6%. 2280. As we mentioned, tech companies reacted to President Trump's executive order on immigration. Google's parent company Alphabet sagged 2.5%. Intel slipped about 1.4%. Apple down about 0.25%. Talked about Boeing's multi-billion dollar deal to sell planes to Iran. Boeing touched down nearly 1.25% today. Oil prices down. U.S. benchmark crude fell about 1% to $52.63 a barrel. Bond prices down as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.49%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The executive order from the White House on Friday has sparked protests both here and abroad and is raising anxiety here about people deciding not to come here from abroad. The American tourism industry and the millions of jobs that it supports could feel an impact well beyond the seven countries at the center of that ban. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that from New York.
At the Northern California offices of Cyrus Travel USA, long-planned trips to Iran are being wiped out. Cyrus Beheshti owns the company.
Since this morning, we have no one new reservation. The only thing we are getting is canceling the reservations.
At Arabian Horizons in Michigan, Yemen travel specialist Ebrahim Musad says cancellations are coming in nonstop, including from people not covered by the order.
Even the people who have dual citizenship, U.S. passport, you know, they're scared to, they cancel their booking.
Both travel agents say even though they have U.S. citizenship and are in the travel industry, they're not traveling, fearing the rules could change. The seven countries on the list provide less than a tenth of a percent of U.S. foreign visits, but this move could have broader impact if travelers in other countries cancel trips to America out of fear or anger. Hannah Messerly is a tourism professor at George Washington University.
Travelers can easily say, well, we won't go to the U.S. this year. We'll go someplace else.
University of Central Florida tourism marketing professor Alan File isn't sure the executive order alone will have widespread economic impact in America.
The worst disaster tourism can face is economic challenges. So it's the currency exchange and the economic situation which is critical.
The dollar is strong right now, meaning foreigners are already concerned about the cost of visiting. It's too soon to know the broader impact, but in the short term, businesses in numerous American immigrant communities are feeling devastating pain and bracing for even worse, such as Ebrahim Mossad.
Close up. We have to shut down. It's kind of hard, you know.
He says if business gets worse, people will lose their jobs. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Delta Airlines is mostly back up and running today after an as yet publicly undefined systems failure yesterday. A couple 300 flights canceled in all. This episode comes on the heels of other recent technical issues that have caused travel woes for Delta and some of its competitors as well. And if it seems like technology is causing more and more problems for the industry and its passengers, it is. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
So we don't know what caused the problems at Delta yet, but there are a lot of systems at work to get planes away from gates and in the air. More systems are automated, and increasingly, airlines are pointing to that automation as the reason for delays. Andrew Kemmett-Mueller follows aviation for Uptake.
That is a new event in aviation. We haven't seen that used as a reason for the delay very often before the last, I would say, 12 months.
For example, Robert W. Mann Jr., an airline industry analyst, says cancellations about a week ago at United Airlines were caused by a hiccup in communicating weight information.
These are all mission-critical systems for airlines, and they literally cannot operate without them. So the degree of reliability, redundancy, robustness is something that airlines look at all the time. Nevertheless, we have these occasional, you know, headline failures.
But whereas technology is relatively new to be blamed for delays, it's also making them much less common. Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly says the industry just set a record in November for fewest cancellations in the U.S.
Delta, especially, you know, it's earned these billions of dollars in profits, and it has taken a little of that and invested it back in technology and has actually been overall running an extraordinarily reliable airline. The flip side of it, though, is that the more reliant you become on technology, sometimes when things go wrong, they go very wrong.
And remember, if technology fails you and your flight's delayed, it is there to entertain you while you wait. I'm Jed Kim from Marketplace.
Shares of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's holding company, followed the general trend on Wall Street today, down 0.2% or so to close at $246,500 a share. Not a typo. The lofty price due mostly to the fact that Buffett has never split Berkshire shares, a testament to his investing philosophy, which is, in a nutshell, you got to be in it for the long haul. There's a new documentary out about Buffett, more about his early days than his current exalted status. It debuts on HBO tonight. It's called Becoming Warren Buffett. Peter Kuhnhartz, the director. Peter, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Here's the thing about Warren Buffett. And honestly, this film didn't do much really to dispel my impression of him. And that is this. He is an avuncular old grandpa type guy. Who has Coca-Cola and Oreos for breakfast and eats junk food and has a great sense of humor. But he is about as cutthroat a businessman and a competitive son of a gun as you're ever going to see. Is that fair?
That's everything I hear. That's fair, that he is as competitive as they come and that he doesn't like to lose. I do think, though, that he has a moral compass that will not allow him to do things to achieve more that in a way that he would not be proud of.
Yeah, there's a line from the film where I think it's Charlie Munger speaking, his longtime business partner at Berkshire Hathaway, and it's a line about buying a fair company at a great price, and now he buys great companies at a fair price or something like that, right?
Exactly. Early on, Warren would buy very cheap stocks knowing he could squeeze a few more dollars out of them. And they weren't particularly good companies. And Charlie really turned him around to make him recognize the value of good companies and what they could produce over the long term.
You know, it's funny. So we had him on the show, I don't know, it must have been 4 or 5 years ago now. And I asked him about See's Candy, mostly because there's one up the street from my house here in L.A. And he is a detail guy. He will get the reports from See's Candy down to, I think, the individual store level and check sales and all of that stuff. I mean, it's this is his milieu, right? The data and the numbers and the essence of it.
Completely. And, you know, his son Howie told us that his father is a computer and the hard drive just does not run out. What he stores in there, the amount of data that he stores in there is reflected in the way he runs his business, so that knowing what those See Candies cost in each of those stores is something that he naturally is interested in and would retain.
He is wired just differently, and he basically admits this. He says at some point in the film,
I was genetically blessed with a certain wiring that's very useful in a highly developed market system where there's lots of chips on the table, and I happen to be good at that game.
He doesn't take credit for that. He's the first to say every life has equal value. I happen to be lucky to be wired at a time when this sort of wiring makes a lot of money for me. But it's worked against him too. His childhood, he had difficulties fitting in, and it really was his wife, Susie, who, when she came on the scene, and if he had this giant brain, she had an equally giant heart, and she did everything she could to bring him out of himself and to socialize him and to make him much more comfortable with people around him. So that by the end of the film, he says, if it wasn't for Susie, Berkshire Hathaway wouldn't have happened. I would have not have been as successful as I have been.
There's a phrase that runs through this film, and it is compound interest. And Warren Buffett is a devotee of it, the strength of it and the power of it. But he talks a lot about the time that it takes for compound interest to work. And the catch, of course, is that now he lives and operates in a world where time has been shrunk, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's true. You know, if I personally took one lesson away from it, is that compound interest works if you have patience. And he feels that today's society of investors is largely not patient enough. So he attributes it to time, and he's an incredibly patient man.
Becoming Warren Buffett is the film. It's on HBO. Peter Coonhart wrote it and directed it and produced it and did all that stuff. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
It's on HBO tonight, by the way. We've got that interview I did with Warren Buffett a couple of years ago on our website. It is marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a word or two on why, in a marketplace sense, the events of this past weekend matter. The reason the American capital markets are the most stable, the most liquid, and the most trusted in the world is that the rule of law in this country means something. You come here to do business. You come to invest in American companies. You buy into the full faith and credit of the United States because you know that the law applies equally to all comers. If that turns out not to be the case, at the stroke of a pen and without as much as a nod to Congress or the courts, then a stock or a bond is just a piece of paper. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 122 points today, 0.6%, 19,971. NASDAQ off 47 points, about 0.8%, 56.13. The S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.6%, 22.80 there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.